Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to this episode of All Things Policy. There's been enough discussion on the kind of economic impact that the coronavirus can have on the world's economies, on the poor people of the world, and different sorts of economic impacts that it can have. But we want to step away from that, and today we specifically want to talk about the measures that India can undertake in order to mitigate some of these economic impacts, so look at more in forms of solutions. Within solutions, I think there are two things that we can focus on. One aspect is what can be done right now in terms of relief to the people who are hurt the most by something like this. And the second part is a slightly longer term reconstruction once the pandemic retreats. So to do this, I have Nitin Pai with me. Welcome to the podcast, Nitin.
Hi, Anupam. Good to be back.
Hi. Let's just first talk about the relief measures. So the initial response from both the Ministry of Finance and Reserve Bank of India has been at least in the right direction. They've started in terms of, easing liquidity, and they've made payments easier. So Ministry of Finance has announced a 1.7 trillion rupees or $22.7 billion relief package. And this includes some form of direct cash transfers, some form of even food distribution, insurance for healthcare workers, etc. RBI, on its own hand, has slashed interest rates. It's allowed deferral of interest payments, installment payments. And then the Ministry of Finance has also, made few things easier for businesses in terms of delayed GST interest collections, etc. So this is what has been done already. So I think the first step is this enough? Is there something else that we could be doing? And how would that look like?
Yeah, Anupam. See, I think we've been talking about this. There seem to be three distinct but interconnected issues. The first is relief. This is humanitarian relief for those hardest hit by the pandemic as well as by the lockdown. The second is an economic stimulus to get the economies back online after the sudden shock that they've suffered in the last 2 months. And the third is a longer-term reconstruction plan to tide through the economic downturn slash recession slash depression that might arise in the near future. And I think we should be more or less circumspect in the sense that the downturn is real. A recession is quite likely, and a depression is a distinct possibility, right? So what we've got to do, therefore, is to align these three objectives, which is relief, stimulus, and reconstruction, in the same general direction, such that they reinforce each other rather than be wasteful. Because we don't have the option of being wasteful at this stage, because we're talking about an overall ticket size of about 10% of GDP, or more, or in the next 2 to 3 years, right? So that's a huge kind of an offset. It's probably half the tax collected, right? So we'll be spending half the taxes collected in just over a year or so. So we don't have opportunities to be wasteful. We have got to think through this and make sure everything is aligned and everything is mutually reinforcing.
Right. So that's three things. Relief, what can be done right now. Rebound, if I might call it in some ways, to get the economy moving. And then a long-term reconstruction plan. So let's talk about the relief. The things that I think the Ministry of Finance first kind of just focused on the relief aspect of it, not really any form of long-term things. But even there, I think you had written something about how something like the PM's Care Fund or Chief Minister's Relief Fund is not enough, that it requires actually more direct to, citizen to citizen sort of transfers through the JAM. Can you elaborate a bit more on that?
Yeah, I think first of all, the criticism leveled against the finance minister's announcement, as well as the prime minister's announcements, I think are a little misconstrued and misdirected. Because even if a lot of the expenditure which is being announced in the finance minister's 1.7 lakh crore plan, even if the some of the expenditure is a rehash of the past, it's important for the government to signal that it is willing to put money on the table and money in the pockets of people, and is prepared to do unconventional things to get that done. So to that extent, the quick announcement by the finance minister was, well received, even if the details have to be worked out. I mean, nobody expects details to be worked out in 24 hours or 48 hours, but over a period of time, I'm sure the details will be worked out to the extent that they can be worked out, right? The second is the use of funds like PM CARES and the Chief Minister's Relief Funds in various states. Now, this is a vestige of the past, right? Because in the 50s and the 60s, when we had disasters, we used to have a centralized fund administered by the Prime Minister or the Chief Minister, who had the discretion to spend it on relief activities, usually ex gratia payments, humanitarian relief, food, clothing, shelter, which needs to be arranged in a very quick period of time, and so forth. So this was necessary at a time when we did not have sophisticated, discriminating instruments that we could use to direct relief, right? And also the size of those crises were much smaller than what we are facing now. So, 10,000 crores, 20,000 crores are a small amount of money compared to, 10 lakh crores, right? So it's like an entirely different ticket size. So while there is some sense in continuing with these PM and CM relief funds in whatever format, whether it's PM CARES or relief fund, doesn't matter, right? I mean, name hardly matters. Administratively, it also doesn't matter because it's, it's government money channelized in one way or the other. What is interesting there is that it can do a few things, right? It can, for example, provide mass relief, over a large area in terms of large-scale distribution of food, supplies, etc., which is difficult for others to reach, right? The state has the administrative capacity, the heavy lift capacity to get things to people in a short period of time in an emergency. So it makes sense to use those funds for such things. And also in some places, there are no markets, there are no shops. So if you want to provide food and, medicines, etc., you might have to physically deliver the goods because people will not be in the ability to use the money to go and shop for it somewhere, right? So those functions are important and they must continue in some form or the other. But here's the problem, right? The marginal cost of public funds is 3 rupees to a rupee. Ajay Shah and the others have found this out. And this is a fantastic number which we always have to remember. It costs Indian society 3 rupees for every rupee the Indian government spends. It does not matter what purpose the government spends it for, whether it's for defense, for disaster relief, for healthcare, or for sanitation. The rupee spent by the government costs Indian society 3 rupees. That's, in other words, it's highly inefficient.
Yeah.
But we still have to do it because, government has to provide defense. So what if it costs 3 rupees for a rupee? You still have to do defense. But when it comes to a ticket size of 10 lakh crores, we can't afford that kind of profligacy, right? We cannot afford that kind of inefficiency.
Yeah, suddenly this number becomes daunting. And I mean, you're talking about 30 lakh crores or something in that line as cost to society. And that's suddenly really scary, right?
Yeah, that's right. Right. So, for example, if you're talking about 30% of GDP needs to be used up to spend 10% of GDP, it's not, it's a mind-boggling number, right?
Yeah.
So we need to find more efficient ways. And luckily for us, in the last 5 years, we have this entire financial inclusion, identification, smart internet, mobile internet, and so forth. The Jandhan Aadhaar Mobile Trinity, Jam Trinity, as Arvind Subramaniam calls it. Or in more practical forms, the UPI infrastructure, Google Pay, etc., which we've been using for the last several years. Now, these allow us to transfer money from citizens through another citizens without having to go through the administrative route of government, which means theoretically the transaction costs and the overall marginal cost of expenditure becomes much lower, right? So you probably will be spending much less than a rupee to transfer that rupee, right? My sense is that's going to be very close to zero. But okay, it's a small number. Even if you say it's 10 paise to a rupee, it's much, much lower than 3 rupees to a rupee. So we can do that. So we already do that. In fact, in the last few weeks, we've heard of so many people transferring cash through UPI into the pockets of their domestic help, the neighborhood vendors and others whom they want to support. So they've been doing it through Google Pay and UPI. Some people have actually been giving cash, right? Now, this is the way Indian society has traditionally looked after itself, by social contributions. Now, can we make this scale at a national level? So one of the ideas we've been talking about is, can we create a social security account? For example, your Jan Dhan account, wherein it's possible for me as an individual to pay money, you as an individual to pay money into, maybe an NGO wants to put money into it, maybe a state government wants to put money into it, or a union government wants to put money into it, into different schemes. So you can look at it as a bucket with several taps. And the bucket can therefore take water, in this case money, from much more than one tap. Right? So a lot of people can fill the bucket at the same time. The bucket gets filled faster and adequately. Now, if we do this on a nationwide scale, it means that we will be able to, you know, spend that 10% of GDP to help people. I mean, okay, relief is not all 10%. Let's not exaggerate. Maybe about 2 to 3% of GDP, which we need for relief, which we'll be able to do much more efficiently using this method. Now, all that needs to be done in this KI effort to enable this is for government to announce that they encourage this and they designate, let's say, the Jan Dhan account as the social security account and say that, you know, we will provide tax deductions to people who do that, you know, make those contributions. That's all it requires. And then the government can...
Right. And that should be easy to do.
Yeah, that's pretty easy to do. In terms of administrative cost, it's very low administrative cost because the infrastructure is all there. And we've spent the last 5 years really building up that infrastructure and popularizing it. So now is actually the time to unroll a plan like this.
Yeah. And so that's what I think this way society will actually save on a lot. It's far more efficient. So a lot more people are targeted. It's far more effective. And then you can still use something like the relief fund or care fund, etc., for people who are left out of this bracket, who are not even part of the Jam Trinity, who don't have bank accounts, etc. The government can still step in there. Or as you said, someone who's so remote that they don't have access to banking channels.
As a short-term measure, yes. But over a longer term, I think it's important to get everybody enrolled into this program. So having a phone makes it much easier for people to enroll. But I'm sure there are ways you can get non-phone-owning people also enrolled into the program. Because it's about essentially having a bank account, right? It's having a, not even a bank account, an account, which can be kept in a bank for safekeeping, but, you know, administered by government. And it's not, you know, it's within the realm of the possible. It's the, you know, today, 2020 is a time when we can actually go and say every single citizen in the country can have such an account.
Yeah, definitely. And thinking that you can actually carry out an entire UPI transaction just based on SMS. So you don't even need a smartphone. A feature phone is more than enough. I think we're, you know, slowly beginning to at least see that this can be done in quite a short period of time. But let's move on from relief to slightly bigger issues, to, you know, the kind of rebound and reconstruction. But even before we get on to that, I just want to ask, I mean, are we jumping the gun? Are we being presumptuous in already talking about reconstruction and standing up on our feet when, in fact, you know, we don't know how long this pandemic is going to last. We don't know how, what kind of damage it will do, who's going to get affected the most. I mean, we have no clue as to how this thing would all turn out and when we would actually, you know, start kicking in the really, I mean, the reconstruction plan. So are we in a way kind of jumping the gun, or is it that, you know, this is all part of the preparedness? At least we were not prepared when the pandemic hit us, but we can be prepared for when the pandemic retreats.
Two things. First, even before the pandemic hit us, we were in an economic slump, right? The downturn was real and we had to do something very urgent and something extraordinary to get us back onto the growth path. We were talking about 3 to 4% growth before the pandemic really hit us, right? So the need for us to get into economic growth trajectory, which involves something extraordinary, was a given even before the pandemic hit. Now that there is a pandemic, and we are seeing some of our important trading partners like the United States in doldrums the way it is, and the world economy probably going to enter into a recession in the coming quarter or the coming year, we have a fair prognosis that the economic chips will be down for the next few years. Now, depending on whom you talk to, it could be a quick, you know, rebound from that hole, or it could be a longish Great Depression kind of a situation, which means that you have 5 to 10 years of economic slowdown. Now, I'm likely to believe that the rebound will be faster it's not going to be a Great Depression kind of a decade-long kind of thing. Maybe 2 to 3 years is very much likely, because I say this for two reasons. One is we have gone through the Great Depression and the several crises after that. So we understand Keynes in economics, right? We know, for example, where Keynes was right and what Keynesian recipes are recommended with their, you know, modifications and 100 years of learning.
Caveats.
So we know what, the caveats and the modifications and the sophisticated applications of Keynesian economics. We know what needs to be done very broadly and in some amount of nuance, right? So, and it's likely that a crisis is a time when people will have to focus on real economic expertise rather than voodoo economic gyan, right? So I think around the world, we will see a return to some amount of professional economic management, which will help us thrive through the crisis. And I don't expect it to be, you know, a decade and so. But 2 to 3 years is what I would say is my median estimate of how long it's going to take. Now, the second reason I think we will come out of this faster rather than slower is because of demographics in a country like India. India is a huge domestic economy. People will need food, people will need shelter, people will need clothing, people will need basic necessities of life. And I'm not even talking about premium things like cars and air travel and so forth. I'm talking about basic stuff like clothes, food, consumer goods, basic level mobile phones, basic level technological equipment, etc. That itself, for a young demographic, will be a growth industry, right? All you need to do is to enable, provide that galvanizing effect to get the economy back on track in economic terms, to tide through this shock to the aggregate demand. Now, we've got to push that aggregate demand up. And, even without getting into too deep of Keynesian economics, there are two things which obtain, right? First is industries and consumers hold back on investment and spending at these times because they're not sure of the future. They're uncertain whether their investments will bear fruit. You know, companies will not invest because they're not sure whether the demand will pick up. Individuals will not spend because they want to save. Yeah, consumers will not buy stuff because they'll save. Because they'll say, okay, this is a rainy day, so let's not be too profligate with our money. Let's be prudent. Now, these two things come together and make the slump longer than it needs to be, right? So the second thing, therefore, comes into play is to say that if government goes and says, look, we are going to signal that we are going to do a massive expenditure in public works, let's say in building infrastructure, the fact that the government is committed to large amounts of spending for a long period of time will give confidence to private investors and to consumers to invest and spend respectively, right? So I think that's the first thing which the government reconstruction or rebound plan needs to achieve, to give confidence to industry and consumers that there is a large amount of government spending, priming, pump priming, whatever you want to call it, which is in the offing in the next 1 to 3 year time frame. The moment that happens, you will start creating confidence in the minds of people.
Yeah, and large parts of it is just about this, I mean, again, to use Keynesian terms, it's this animal spirit, right? That once you have someone as big as the government beginning to spend, I think everyone else would want to also jump in that bandwagon. And in fact, businesses will feel left out if they're not on board on some of these things. So you will certainly have economic activities which will begin to pick up, and then consumers also now have this confidence. They will start buying stuff. And once they will start buying stuff, again, this entire the positive kind of feedback loop start getting in, because once people buy stuff, demand picks up, then you'll have to supply that demand. Investment picks up. Once investment picks up, new jobs, new incomes, higher incomes, etc. So that entire kind of economic activity.
You had some data from the Bhanumurthy paper about the multiplier effect of capital expenditure, right?
Right. So that's, I think, very interesting. Since we're talking about, again, relief and reconstruction here, there's two very important things in terms of this multiplier effect. So what I was explaining is nothing but what you would call as a multiplier effect. That is, if government spends 1 rupee, how much will GDP increase by? If the GDP increases exactly just by 1 rupee, then there is no multiplier at all. I mean, it's just exact, you know, corresponding amount. But let's say the government spends 1 rupee and GDP increases by 2 rupees, then the multiplier is 2, essentially. So it's important to see what that multiplier effect is, and then also to see, is that multiplier kind of constant or is it different according to different sectors? And you would find, you know, very interesting things. That is, the multiplier for all forms of, you know, direct transfers is basically unitary, or just actually just below unitary, in fact. So if the government spends 1 rupee, GDP actually goes up just about by 1 rupee. But very interestingly, for something like infrastructure or in any form of capital expenditure, the multiplier is more like 4.28, which is that, you know, 1 rupee spent by government increases GDP by 4.28 rupees. I think that should tell you that, you know, once you get into this reconstruction mode, it's very important that you focus on the right things, and capital expenditure is definitely one of it. And given that India has, you know, naturally as it is, even before the pandemic and so on, India has a massive infrastructure deficit. I think it's a no-brainer that we should go after big infrastructure projects, like something like the Marshall Plan of the 1930s, to do that now.
Yeah, I think that, I'm like both of us, and including our colleague Pranay, we are all fiscal hawks. We are very, very, very nasty when it comes to fiscal deficits. I mean, we've been uber hawks on this. But depression is a time when you don't worry so much about fiscal deficit, because fiscal deficits will not cause the macroeconomic problems which you normally have when the economy is at potential, right? So you won't suffer so much of crowding out and inflation when that happens. What is interesting is that if you look at infrastructure specifically, this lasts for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, right? When New York, for example, built the metro, started building the metro in the 1910s and 20s, it still exists today. It's a 100-year project, right? So the metro expenditure, which was incurred in 1920s, is still used by New Yorkers in the year 2020, 100 years later.
Absolutely. I mean, the expressways in 1936 as part of the, you know, the Roosevelt, you know, plan after the depression is, you know, that is exactly the lifeline of America today. And it in fact, you know, is still feeding into the automobile frenzy, etc., because you have such nice expressways. So any such massive infrastructure undertakings, whether it's a port, whether it's a bridge, whether it's expressways, will last us 100 years. So even when you look at fiscal deficit, you shouldn't be looking at this particular thing on a year-on-year basis. I mean, it's really a long-term plan.
Yeah. So if a fiscal deficit means that you're borrowing from your children and grandchildren, building infrastructure means that you're giving things to your children and grandchildren. So using fiscal deficits to build out long-term infrastructure like cities, highways, railways, metros, ports, airports, I think is a good way to spend the money and also to kickstart economic growth. Now, the second thing here is to relate it back. If the multiplier on investment in infrastructure is 4 point something, and if the social cost of spending is 3 rupees to a rupee, I think spending money on infrastructure is probably the best use of government's expenditure, right? Because you're getting maximum returns on the social costs of government spending. So in a way, infrastructure spending is a no-brainer. And we know, for example, we need a lot more, you know, bridges, roads, airports, railways, metros, etc. And my favorite project here is really to build the 100 cities which Narendra Modi promised when he was a prime ministerial candidate in 2013. Built 100 new cities, maybe 4 or 5 in each state, which will create the necessary impetus for such kind of infrastructure spending to take off. Okay, public service announcement. If you're hearing a groaning or a snoring noise, it's not me, my dog. It's my dog. He's just lying down next to my computer and snoring very loudly. So that's his contribution to this conversation.
And I think when we speak about cities as well, you might hear a groaning or a snoring noise by the listeners, because we've been speaking about it for 5 or 6 years, but there's been nothing that's happened on that front, which is a shame, really, because that was, I think, if anything at all, it signaled in 2013 that there was a recognition of this, that cities can actually be a very good solution for lots of things, from agricultural distress to getting the economy, you know, soaring at 10%. Cities are the answers, but not much has been done since then. But we'll leave that ruling for later. But just final aspect on this is that, I mean, many of us could probably be wondering, you know, how can we finance something like this? That is, you know, all of our these measures that we are talking about could be something in the tune of 8% of GDP, 10% of GDP. We're not sure over a 2 to 3 year time frame, and then, you know, a little bit more as we go on. But I would just kind of, you know, want to weigh in here and say that funding is actually not a problem. If you look at global liquidity issues at this moment, there is a lot of fund. I mean, in fact, I would argue that the world is awash with liquidity, with people really not knowing where to invest their money in, which is why you would suddenly see that there's a spike in investment in US Treasury bills, because that's the safest kind of investment. So if you can think of a situation where, I mean, everyone's exited equity markets around the world, emerging markets, even the debt market has gone down. You can see currencies crashing across the world, etc., because people are, you know, all kinds of investors are retreating from emerging markets and going back into the safe havens. Which means that it's actually easy to tap into some of those things. The global bond market, for example, should be a leeway for us to get into this financing. The only thing important is that, again, you make it a safe haven. I mean, it cannot be as safe as, let's say, US bonds, but we can get that. But India can offer about 4x the amount of returns that US can. And that's, I think, a very important thing. And you would see that investors can flock to the Indian growth story again. So I think it's important that, you know, if you kind of say that we're building these large infrastructure projects, have transparency in them, and then give some form of government assurance, government backing, you will have investors waiting to kind of lend to India. And it's just not private investors. You have all sorts of investors. You have, for example, of course, mutual funds across the world, but you also have sovereign wealth funds from, let's say, the entire Middle East, which is awash with money and they don't know where to put that in. Similarly, the Norwegian kind of sovereign wealth fund, I'm sure, would want to make some smart bets about India's growth story. So, I mean, there are multiple such sources. I don't think that's a problem. Indian diaspora itself would probably want to have a slice of this pie. So, funding is not really the problem. It's about what you do with that funding. As we spoke earlier, if you just spend, you know, once the relief and bit is done, if during the reconstruction phase, we just spend on transfers, then I don't think, you know, you're going to, again, win back. It's not fiscally prudent at that point of time, but spending on infrastructure, large infrastructure projects, etc., can, in fact, you know, I mean, do India a whole world of good. So that, I think, is the way forward in the, and this is probably a five-year time frame that we are probably looking at, Nitin.
Yeah. And also the fact that we have to give the investor the assurance that over a 30-year period, we're not going to change the rules of the game, right? One of the challenges of investing in India, or the bugbears of investing in India in the last 15, 20 years, has been the frequent changes of the rules of the game when the game is being played or after the game is being played. So suddenly you'll have a Supreme Court judgment, or you'll have a retrospective taxation, or you'll have some kind of a sting in the tail, which leaves the investor feeling either with a bitter aftertaste or feeling shafted. Right. So we'll have to figure out how to ensure that that doesn't happen. I think one easy way to do that is to have special purpose vehicles, and which sell bonds, you know, which are for specific projects, highways or ports or railway lines or, you know, airports and such infrastructure, which are very, very, very tightly ring fenced in terms of, you know, where does the money come from, where does the money go, and, you know, how does the business model work, and eliminate a lot of the legislative and regulatory ambivalence or, you know, lack of clarity when it comes to some of these things. But overall, also, the government will have to sell bonds, I suppose, as the equivalent of T-bills at various interest rates for various purposes. For example, Narayan's point was that you have to separate it into two types of bonds that you sell. One is you sell it to sovereign wealth funds and Japanese development fund grants and all that, which will be low interest, long-term patient capital. Whereas to Indian diaspora, you might want to price it competitively with other investments that they might be able to make, so that it's a higher interest yielding financial product, but you sell it to the Indian diaspora. Yeah, shorter duration and to the Indian diaspora.
Yeah. So that's, I think, broadly the plan of action that we have. There's multiple other things which I think would have remain the same with or without the pandemic, like get your regulatory thing in check, solve the banking crisis. I know I'm saying this kind of in an offhand way, as though it's very easy to do, but these things we had to do with or without the pandemic. But if this can give you a further impetus to get some of these things right, I think we should be focusing on that as well.
Yeah, but I think we should square with our listeners, right? You know, we've not talked about two things. One is we have not talked about this rebound. What do we do to help small businesses to tide through the immediate crisis in terms of working capital, cash flow, etc., which is coming up now? And this is a serious problem, right? We have to figure out how to do that. And the second is, how do we relax the lockdown? So what is the unlock up process? Once this lockdown is finished on the 14th of April, what's next? Now, on both these fronts, we don't have as much clarity in our own thinking as we've had in the relief and the reconstruction bits. So in future conversations, let's hope we will be able to at least come up with clarify our own thinking before we share it with anybody else.
Yeah, so just look out for that. All right, Nitin, thank you so much for joining in, and thanks everyone for joining in as well. Join us again tomorrow for the next episode of All Things Policy.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.